Okay, it's back on again.
Okay. Yeah, this is a little print done in 1975 in conjunction with a group of artists. We were invited up to the University of South Dakota by Lloyd Menard, and so we each did a print. I think there were half dozen of us, and then Lloyd and his students printed them, and we worked with the students in the printing. So it was a kind of a nice educational program, bringing the students and the artists together. And then it was issued in a quite fancy box, and I think it sold quite well. It sold for to benefit something or other up there. And I guess, you know, I have always been interested in flying, the idea of flight, so forth. I don't know whether I could show this today or not, but actually the symbols of Fly United was a big advertising campaign that United had run. I don't think, I took their slogan literally, but in other words, this kind of humorous takeoff on this was Gerald Fuller Ford. Air Force One was his at that point. And so just a lighthearted look at flight. Well, this is London. This is one of the prints I did during the Guggenheim period, or, 67. I guess I was still there then. Or I might have, by that time, have moved to Rome. I went, after the year in London, I had a chance to go down and work for Dick Kallner at the Tyler School of Art in Rome for a year, taking my press along with me. At any rate, this was, I shared a studio in London with Fran Myers, and it was in Aldgate East, a very raucous, busy section. It was the garment district. It was, our studio looked out on Angel Alley, where was one of the famous crimes of Jack the Ripper had occurred there. As a matter of fact, at 11 o'clock every day, a tour group came through and they pointed to the spot where the unfortunate woman had ended up. And so I did a group of prints around the different tube stations that I had something to do with them. So Aldgate East was the tube stop for this district. So there's the tube here. And there were a great many homeless people in this district. It had been badly bombed in the war, so there were large areas of just empty rubble-strewn lots, and so the homeless people would camp out there, and they'd have fires at night and stuff like that. And of course, in London, you know, you saw a homeless person because they were wearing somebody else's overcoat and shuffling along. And at the same time, there was this kind of lavish, lower-class life that was going on. So it was a fascinating district. Flea markets and thieves markets and things like that down there too. So little bits and pieces, even maybe a little bit of Fran there. Okay. I think the ones with the silver frames were from a retrospective that I sent out. And so I picked prints for this that I particularly liked. And this is one that I like because I think it's really tied up to events that were very upsetting and very close. This is my assassination print. Really, this was the time of assassinations and of the Kennedys getting wiped out, of Martin Luther King getting wiped out, and just sort of one political assassination after another. And then not only the assassins, but the various things around the assassination. The plots, the rumors, the that are and with the Kennedy, of course, still going on. I can say probably in all of these, none of these assassinations has really been put to rest. I think there's just a new book out on Norman Mailer has just come out with a new book on Oswald, and I was thinking about what I wanted to show you and talk about. And there is a print that I don't have, unfortunately, and I think it's a very interesting print, but I did it in a very small edition and they're all gone. Usually I can manage to hang on to a print. I try to hang on to a print, but I did one on the death of Oswald, which it was in this period, but it was a lithograph. And, you know, I think about it every now and then. I don't even have a slide of this print. They're just all gone. But it was, I think, a very interesting take on Oswald. And at this period, I was really influenced by television, which was new to me. I think we had finally gotten a set. And the news was covered so thoroughly in those days, much better than it is now, you know, with the sound bites and everything just read from the teleprompter. But in those days, the people were taking their cameras out and, you know, you were seeing Oswald being shot down before your very eyes in the Dallas police station. And I think I did a litho very directly from what I had seen there. So maybe all of these from this period, from the late 60s, early 70s, are really about war and struggle. I think I had these things on my mind. They were serious. Vietnam was something that was with you daily. And again, the cameras were in on it, you know. Today, of course, the military has ended all that. You don't see anything in Bosnia except the scene outside the hospital doors. You see nothing of the action. This is Verdun. I did two on Verdun. I did Verdun defense and Verdun attack. My father had been in World War I, and so I heard a lot about it. And he had been in a lot of trench warfare there. I don't think he was at Verdun, but that was the great battle. That was the most terrible battle with an immense loss of life. And so, for one reason or another, I think it was just the spirit of the times, I did these two prints. They're exactly the same size. I find it probably as difficult. I showed this one in the retrospective at the Elvium. I didn't show the other because I probably would have been attacked by it, for it. Because the second Verdun defense, you see, they're holding out here against their attackers. But in the Verdun attack, the women are coming up and they're absolutely destroying the men. But unfortunately, they're all nude.
Probably a wise choice on your
part. Well, in that show too, you know, Russell picked that out. Russell and the curators, there were three of us picking the show out, and I think we passed by the nude attacking women. So then this is another one from those days, and this is right out of personal experience. I had picked up Michael Rothenstein, the English printmaker who was visiting artist. I picked him up at the bus station because he doesn't fly. And we drove toward campus, and we drove right into the worst riot of the season. What is it, Williamson Street? I don't know. It's the street that's near campus, which used to be, and it still is, you know, lots of these kind of shaggy two-story apartments, flats. And everyone was there. And so I tried to put every man is in here, you know, the cook and the baker and the candlestick maker and so on. And the students all being taken off to jail. FBI just checking things out, and the student being spread eagled on the car and beaten up a little, and so forth. But it all happened, right? We were stalled, we couldn't move, everything was tear gas. Rothenstein was crying buckets and laughing. Wait till I get back to London, what a wonderful story! So that's, and it's interesting, our Chief Justice, Shirley Abrams, she has a copy of this. She bought a copy of it. And I think this might be the last one I have. Okay, let's see. That's getting us through the 60s and 70s. So I think you can see change in my work, but it hasn't been drastic. I think it's a kind of evolution. I think the I worked my way through dry point and then began to use line etching much more. And then in the recent prints, I'm using soft ground etching much more. Color to much the same degree. And I, for a long time, I've been mixing straight inks with Day-Glow. Day-Glow inks, high-quality Day-Glow inks, but they have certainly been light-fast. You know, Day-Glow has the rumor that it's not light-fast, but I found that I really don't like to use Day-Glow by itself. It has a kind of raw quality, a commercial quality to it, but then when it's softened and mixed with related colors, I don't know whether the finer artist colors kind of protect it or encase it, but I have found it to be very light fast. You know, I've used it in some of these that are 25, 30 years old, and it's still. And this one, which is done in 80, I think, this is 15 years old. And the Day-Glow is still warm. That we made this was used as the poster for, they did a poster from this print, which my son did, actually, who was a graphic designer, and for the Elvium show. And for some reason, the posters that they put out along State Street quickly turned to black. That the day glow faded away absolutely and disappeared itself. But in the print, I really haven't had that trouble. And so I think, you know, I do all sorts of things. Sometimes they are political satires, and sometimes they're just comedies. I think that up front, my tendency is to be funny. And sometimes it's funny, but with a barb in it or a big hook in it, and sometimes just by itself. I think of the I did hunting things where I was making fun of the hunters, although I have been at times a hunter myself, and I don't see anything wrong with it as long as you don't use an assault rifle to shoot a rabbit. But this is part of the country here, and again, this is as that one is out my garden window, and this is out my living room window in the fall here. And it's visually pretty fascinating to see a lot of day glow people come wandering across your land in a snowstorm with these huge rifles, and then you get someone who's too close to the house and you go up there to give them hell, and you see it's a 10-year-old boy with a big huge rifle. Okay, silver frame, meaning one of that I selected because I like it. And I like to do things about the military. You know, I was in the Army when I was 21 years old. So I kind of grew up in 4 intense years in the military, and it's I didn't dislike it. Sometimes it was really fascinating, period. And I enjoyed a great deal of it. So there's a lot of the Army in this. This is poker night at Pentagon. I wanted to do a print about various governmental bureaus or institutions. The Pentagon, and Ronald Reagan was president, so there's a lot of material. And so this is, you know, test drive our new Honda M5. It's listed on this one. And a poker game is going on. And this is the new Army, which is men and women together. And of course, the men are playing strip poker, and the men are losing. This one is really lost. But she has a very good hand, obviously, and this one's beginning to play dirty. So that a lot of times I'm just amusing myself, and one hopes that what amuses me will amuse some other people too. I always hope for an audience. And anyway, here are the generals, the high brass here, of one of which is a woman. I think, you know, from an early point, I accepted feminism and have tried to have equal representation. But they're having a fashion show. And this Navy officer playing aliens from outer space. And then This is the fail-safe system. This is the doomsday board. Fortunately, there is a second thought button. And this is the red phone. If you get a recorded message, dial again. And the State Department person is saying, speak English, you.
So it's a little review.
A little humorous review. Okay. But it's a great highlight. Another military. This time it's in a silo. Boo Boo in silo 16. And again, I couldn't, no one could do this piece without intimate knowledge of the military. And so actually it's kind of a letter that someone's writing home. Dear Mom. It is nice here. We go to class, sing while we march, have short arm inspection on Mondays. Today, I made a boo-boo. And actually, it is a guard dog who's managed to press the button, the red alert button, in the hard hat area. And the peacekeeper is leaving. Anyway,
what's the date on that? 84, is that date?
Date, 84, yes.
Appropriately, 1984.
okay. Now we get more serious. I think you've probably seen these. These are 88. And it's a little religious comedy. The Last Judgment. Update on The Last Judgment. I did a series of drawings for a little magazine called White Walls in Chicago, and then carried that into the prints. Oh, where working from the triptych idea, it's very popular in the Northern Renaissance, of the doomed, the dead souls, the dead. Being carried to judgment one way or another, being brought to the place of judgment and being judged and being sent. I mean, in the Renaissance idea, everyone loved the idea of all of the rich people going to hell. I mean, there was very little focus on the ones that went to heaven, but there's great detail. And sometimes there was a separate panel of them all being in hell, being anally bothered by so forth. So, but this, for a contemporary look at it, it is on Air Death. Now the stewardess is saying, thank you for flying Air Death. And they're giving them free cigarettes and free drinks. And then this is the place of judgment. Being judged. This is the debarkation from Air Death on some dark, mysterious airfield. They're met by a cadre of demons and angels. They put into jogging suits and carried to the grand stairway where they go to be judged. Except there's an express bus for Episcopalians. There's God dealing out the sentences. He's fully computerized so that the entire life is immediately exposed, and so judgment is instantaneous. This is someone who does get a good berth in heaven, where she gets a bungalow and an economy car, fishing rights, so forth. And here we have a monster waiting for this bat.
Well, I think you've sealed your own fate.
You never know. I might really. There might be a big change in my life. I wonder. These are, you know, the 80s, mostly 80s now. I did a group of three on the future. I think the best of which is this one. The work in the future. That perhaps my work has gotten, the attempt is a little more at humor recently. Although this is somewhat serious too. So we see the humans have taken a very minor place on this work line. And they are kind of the gophers, and they're shining up the robots and taking care of the robots who are in control. And on the coffee machine, there's a warning, human grade coffee. I guess that's...
Is that a part of the series?
Yeah, it's a rough series. There are three related prints. The other two prints are both large, and this one's small. They weren't really, you know, like portfolio prints where they're all the same size. So this is an ambitious print and a kind of strange print. The reasoning behind the print is that I had been looking at salon painting of the 19th century. These big painting machines that were put into the competition at the Louvre every year in France. Where the painters would knock themselves out, and they did. It's kind of journalistic. Paintings were popular, and they were of battles, things that everyone knew about, but they hadn't seen it. And disasters were a favorite. And so Jericho, Theodore Jericho, did this enormous painting. It's now in the Louvre, of the Raft of the Medusa, detailing the terrible happenings on board this raft by the survivors of a sinking at sea. And so it's such a serious subject that it awakens my inclination to not handle it seriously. So I was really looking for comedy, and yet it's not entirely comic either. but it's material for narrative and action and drama. And
have you ever read the Julian Barnes piece on this?
I no.
I'll have to get you a copy of that.
No,
it's
I haven't.
It's a marvelous
yeah.
essay.
Yeah. Yeah.
It uses it as a kind of background.
Yeah. You know, it was much written about and much a part of dramatic incidents, movies, and mm-hmm. so forth. I guess that, but the you have a lot of information for, about it. And I also, you know, in the early days, in the 50s, I did a lot of crossing the North Sea in small boats, and I mean the inexpensive way to go to Europe for students and young faculty was to go on the Greek Line, which mm-hmm. came out of Montreal, went up the St. Lawrence, and took the northern route over, where you and the You did see, you know, it was a very active sea. You saw whales, porpoises, dolphins. You saw all kinds of things in that violent ocean that's in the North Sea. And the boats that passed you were, you know, they looked just like that. They were standing on their front or standing on their rear. And the dining table, you know, had this little railing around it as the food would go down one time. So I think that there's a lot of that in it. And it still had a lot of kind of silly social life hanging over from the days of the Titanic. You did have tea dance at 4 o'clock. Yeah, the poor little trio sawing away up there were swaying one way and swaying the other. I did two of these, hanging off the other. This one came first, and it was a little simpler. Basically, have you know, a lot in common. And of late, I have been resisting getting too involved in really tendentious use of color. In other words, I could have another plate, you know, and make these little spots of color, or I could simply paint them. And these days I am tending to paint them. That this is, it's a color etching, it's on two plates, but the additional small spots of bright color here and there are put in with watercolor. This is kind of an interesting thing. This is actually, I found that by dropping whiting, the powdered whiting, like talc, onto the plate, it prints dead white where you do that. And so I was using that to have little highlights in the glaciers. And of course all the portholes are done with my drill set. It's great for doing portholes. I think I'll just show the NEA, and maybe that's a good place to stop. Thank you. this was an ambitious piece. I had done versions of this, paintings of versions, about 5 years ago, 6 years ago, and then I, the NEA, which has been very helpful to me, I've had, I guess, three artist fellowships and one printmaking fellowship. And it's been at very good times when I needed the time off to really concentrate. And so I'm very sympathetic to them, I think, as any artist should be. So this is in support of the NEA, but I approach it by making a comedy, a comic incident, to try to draw people into the NEA. And it's an incident that I've seen happen in any jury that is during a big competition. And I've been on two of their regional juries. And they have their carousels all arranged, and sometimes something is upside down. But you never go back at an NEA jury. You know, you get one, you get your look at it, you get your chance to vote it in or out, and if it's upside down, you go upside down to look at it, if you're that curious. So in this incident, there is one who's going upside down. And then, you know, just having a little fun with the idea of the NEA and what their headquarters building would look like, and using that as an excuse to do a beautiful job with marbling on the column here, and then their marbling work. That's
is that?
Well, that's that is.
Airplane?
No. That is you use a big tank of water and you put some tarry stuff in the water, and you use a spatula and a whisk to get it mm-hmm. going, get it shaped up, and then you take your plate upside down, so it's faced toward mm-hmm. the water, and you smack it and mm-hmm. pull it up. So then you can etch it. So it's a lovely technique. It's hard to do, but it's fun to do. Mm-hmm. And students love to do it. They make the most ungodly mess you've ever seen. So I'm always looking for an excuse to do some marbling. Marbling in all the columns. Mm-hmm.
These textures.
And that's...
How did you get those?
I guess the basic is marbling. Yeah, there's marbling behind the texture, and then there's aquatint, soft ground over. Mm. Little pebbly kind of textures.
That's the texture of the ceiling they're referring to.
Yeah. Right, the gilt. Right. The gilded ceiling, and a proper palace for the NEA with their peacocks. And so forth. But, of course, then the basic, the point of the print is the surrounding watchers and the vicious attackers, the Jesse Helms here with his bundles of tobacco, and the tobacco workers who are turning out Jesse's, and the religious figure, military figure who is eating Art News, and the woman who is cross-eyed, she's reading Robert Mapplethorpe, and this southern figure, and various the Klansmen, and the placard saying war, not sex. Anyway, the enemies of the NEA, which so it's a statement to try to help them along. I did send in a slide of this in my last NEA application, and I received a grant. So, the last one, let's take a look at one of the prints that I did for the last faculty. So this is as large as I can work, as large as I will work. I don't know how often I will go to this size, but I have now equipment to handle prints this size. This is, let's see, it's 32 by 48. Beyond that, you have to go to another kind of paper. You have to use paper on a roll.
Is this a single copper plate?
Two copper plates. So it's an effort. It was, I had a very good assistant. Ann Gratch is working with me. She's very skillful. So she could have, really, she inked the color plate and I inked the key plate. And she did the roller work. So it was a good time to work on this, and it did get my equipment. I got the required getting special tanks built, and I guess that, and I made a special acid closet, which we can look at this stuff in the studio after this. So I guess that's a pretty comprehensive look at my work. I think I have done close to 225 prints. Give or take, there. That's not an exact count, but it's in the neighborhood of that. And all of them are printed in addition, which is another factor. I think a lot of people do prints, and they do one or two. But the kind of prints I do, I think it's a great waste if you only do one or two. My editions are anywhere from 10 to 25 these days. That's a usual figure. And at times I have done editions of 75, 50, so far. I really like to be in control of the printing. I have a number of times worked with printers. And it's been frustrating. I'm not a natural collaborator. I like to be in charge. I think it's comes from teaching. It comes it comes from being opinionated and stubborn, and from being able to do all the technical stuff. I mean, I am an excellent printer. I have printed all my life, ever since turning to etching, and I am very skillful. But first and foremost, I'm an idea person. I'm a storyteller. You know, these are narrative prints. I'm dealing with all kinds of ideas. They're usually humorous ideas, or they are kind of double-headed ideas where there's humor and there's a political point. There's something that's seeking a kind of awareness. They might be an educational thing, or I'm selling a point of view, perhaps. But it's a various kind of thing. I spend more time on prints than on painting, but I do paint steadily. We haven't looked at any paintings. There is a body of paintings. I don't have, you know, with prints, you have a pretty complete treasury of prints in the shop that you can pull out. With paintings, they go, and that's it. They're gone. It would really be very, you know, I could do a retrospective show in prints. It would be very hard to do a retrospective in painting. And I don't really have the records telling where they are. In most cases, you know, private individuals buy them, and the galleries keep a record, but I don't. That's not really a great importance to me.
Are any of your paintings in museum collections?
Yeah, one was just bought out of the last Chicago show I had by the Arkansas Center, Art Center. The Chicago Art Institute has a big painting. My paintings are on paper, and they're done with water-soluble material, and they're done with drawing tools, too. So they are as much drawings as paintings. They're drawings with color. Milwaukee Art Institute, Art Museum, has probably about three. They've got the one of the paintings of the Titanic, for example. I did two paintings of the Titanic, and they have one of them, and they also have the print.
When you spoke of your painting at Berkeley, was that same kind, or was that oil?
It was oil. It was both.
Early on, you were painting in oil.
I was painting in oil. Yeah, and I, you know, I've still got a few of the oil paintings. I was going to bring one down to show you, but it's in the attic, and it's big, and our stairs are difficult. And I think there's enough. Mm-hmm. There's enough to see here. No, I really was a pretty good painter in oil. I pick them up every now and then. I give it another try, but it's so slow. You really have to build. There are other materials now that are much faster. I like oil paintings. You know, the paintings that I see that I like are the oils. They're much richer, I think, than acrylics. And my painting in water-soluble materials on paper, and you can get such great papers now, you know, you get big papers, wonderful handmade sheets, and I prefer it. And so I go with my preferences at this point.
Let me ask about your color in the later works. It seems to have modified substantially. I think you referred to it a little bit earlier, from the somewhat garish, noisy loudness earlier to the sort of northern European softening of the shades and so forth. Is that a conscious transformation?
Not conscious, no. Mm-hmm.
So a lot mellower.
Yeah. I think it comes and goes. Well, maybe with the subject matter. These three, they got a little darker than I wanted. You know, these last three big ones. I think they read okay. But I don't think it's a big tendency. I would agree with you that there's a certain that these are dark, and the black plate tends to dominate, and the color is, in this one, it's kind of pleasant color, and it's kind of secondary to the figuration.
Could you talk a little bit more about color and what it means and,
yeah.
and everything?
Yeah, well, I like color. I feel at home in using color. I feel I have a lot of knowledge about color. No fears of it. I taught design for quite a while. I never studied design, you know. Cal is a very strange school, really a kind of classic academy. We drew from the cast, you know, and we drew from the model. I think that's one reason I always had the tendency to draw nudes, because I've drawn so many nudes, you know. From age 17, I was drawing and painting nude women. And, either that or still life, fruit, bottles, and so forth. But we had no design. We had something called composition, and that wasn't very much. So I really, my first teaching job, I had to teach design, and the faculty there had come out of really design-oriented schools. So they wanted a hard-nosed design thing. Course. And so I did a lot of reading and working, and I found that I could translate what I was doing in painting into a structured design course, and I could analyze what I was doing. And so I looked at color very analytically and read a great many books at it, and then taught for 4 years. I retained a design course here, and so I feel I know everything about color. I know how to use it. I know. I'm always thinking about the work. For example, I just did a painting, and that painting was influenced by seeing the Whistler show at the National Gallery in Washington recently. And Whistler had been studying Japanese prints, and there was very good critique of the show by someone, one of the curators had it, and it was very helpful to look at the Japanese paintings they had, and that had influenced Whistler, and then they had Whistler's things, and he picked up on the use of color that the Japanese, where they would essentially have very neutral coloration, and then they'd pick out little bits of brightness, often in the clothing and so forth. And you could see that for a while, Whistler was, he picked up on that and he was doing it. And so when I got home, I did it. And I made a painting that, in a way, it's a little different from what I was doing, because it is, I redid the battlefield as a painting, and this time the battlefield is very neutral, very warm, neutral, and everything is very bright, all of the uniforms are very bright. So it's complicated, and it's interesting to do different things with color. I feel I have I have a lot of tools to put down what I want, and perhaps why etching still fascinates me is that the material, the process, has a mind of its own. It doesn't always go where you want it to go. You know, you work with acid, which is very unpredictable. It changes with temperature, It changes with the mix. It changes as the water evaporates off. It gets stronger. So that you will invest in this big plate and something, and it comes out of the acid, and it's not what you thought you would have. You have something entirely different. And my tendency then is to go along with it and to try to angle it toward what I had in mind, but to accept what the process has done to it, but to control it, like a wild horse.
How much preliminary drawing do you do before you start working on the plate?
It varies. I don't like to do too much, though. I really like to have a certain amount of the exploration be in the final piece. My tendency is to do the idea over several times. And I had played with the idea of Audubon. I did a litho on Audubon. I did two small prints on Audubon. And so I had the idea is pretty much the same. He's studying the birds and painting while the place, all of these exotic places in Florida and Louisiana where he worked. And a glimpse of the life there. I did a lot of reading. I did a lot of collecting of books, pamphlets, and things. I go into the situation. We drove around a lot in this area, which is a fascinating area, probably one of the least changed areas in the United States.
Take pictures as you go?
No, I don't really do photographs. Friend takes some. I collect postcards, for one thing. And sometimes I'll do a sketch of something. Or I try to find pamphlets. You stop at a restaurant or a gas station and they have pamphlets about the area. And so that's enough just to see, for example, how the houses are structured. They're up on posts, and they had usually a little stairway up to the attic where somebody would be up here, the kids or so forth. But they had, because all these areas flooded regularly. But I have a pretty retentive eye. And so that's... I guess, the main thing is to enjoy your work, and I do.
You do.
I do, yeah.
So does the viewer.
Well, that's... Yeah. I like that very much. I really do... I like to have an audience or the thought that there will be people who are receptive. And I like other people's art too. The Whistler show was a terrific thing. I think it's going to come down to Chicago. That's the best show I've seen in a while. I mean, he was kind of a flawed person and a flawed artist, but at his best, he was very good.
Do you ever have that in the back of your mind to say you do what you enjoy, but is there this sense of the audience in what you do? How would somebody react to this?
Sure, that's in the back of my mind.
Yeah.
I'm aware, for example, now, I look at some of the things that I've done and I know if I exhibit the work, there will be complaints, like the nude women soldiers. That a lot of people will simply find it humorous and find nothing to object, but there will be objections, and the museums are so sensitive now. They really are running scared. And so, you know, you're not really looking for a big brouhaha. You know, the Elvium had trouble with Otto Dix and George Gross a couple of years ago in the show they ran. So it really has nothing to do with the quality of the artist, but there are very sensitive areas. I mean, I do what I want to do. I'm certainly aware, you know, since I deal with the times that I live in, I deal with the ideas that are current. I get a lot of enjoyment out of drawing straight political drawings, political satires for the progressive. And they have taken everything I've given them and run it, even though a couple of times they've had nasty letters. and there, you know, I feel if you're going to have that kind of a magazine, then they can publish anything. And so when I did the militias a couple of months ago, and I had the militia, you know, they're out reading Soldier of Fortune, and they're sitting in the slit trench, you know. I feel that, you know, it's an adult magazine for intelligent people. And that's basically what I do. I do adult pieces, and I think my audience, they have to have a certain kind of mindset and intelligence. And, you know, people vary a lot, so it's not always the case. There are people that like what I do, and I'm very surprised that they do. But I'm not about to change anything.
It's a good place to
end. Yeah. I think we should end it right there.
All right.